Let me call us to order, please. Please take your seats if you have them. Welcome to this session on the challenges of participation, peace, stability, and relief operations. My name is Daniel Serwer. I'm the Vice President for Peace and Stability Operations here at the U.S. Institute of Peace. And I hope you'll join me in turning off your cell phones. I say that first because I always forget if I leave it to last. Among other things, they affect our electronics, so if you can turn them off completely, that's better. I think you can see from the size of the audience this morning that there are tremendous challenges that the United States and the international community are facing in recruiting, training, equipping, and deploying the growing number of participants in peace, stability, and international relief operations. We actually had, I think, more RSVPs for this session than we've ever had previously for something held in this building. For its part, the UN is engaged in 18 missions involving over 73,000 soldiers, 9,500 police, and 7,700 civilian personnel. There are new operations in Darfur and Chad and other areas that will require thousands of new recruits, in addition to the very real problem of replacements for people who are there. U.S. civilian and military authorities are dealing with the current priority demands of Iraq and Afghanistan. At the same time, they are developing new capacity to implement presidential and department directives to improve our ability to undertake future missions, and we'll have two people this morning talking about defense and states' efforts in those directions. For non-governmental organizations, the challenges and risks of providing humanitarian assistance are clearly growing. While the requirement for their services could hardly be greater, and I note that on CNN this morning, I see that there's a major earthquake off the coast of Indonesia, and while I don't know the consequences of that yet, it's the kind of event that our NGO communities need to be ready for at any moment. The issue before us this morning is how will the U.S. and international community meet these challenges? Where will the soldiers, diplomats, aid workers, civilian administrators, agricultural specialists, and so on come from? How are they going to be selected, trained, deployed, and supported in the field? To address this question, we've got a very distinguished and well-qualified panel. You have their bios. I'm only going to mention their names. We're going to be starting in a minute or two with Ambassador John Herbst, who's the coordinator for the Office of Reconstruction and Stability in the State Department. We'll then turn to General David Fastabend, who's just back from Iraq and who is now Director of Strategy, Plans, and Policy for the United States Army. Then to David Harland. Unfortunately, Jane Holt could not be with us today. To David Harland, now the Director of Europe and Latin America Division, Department of Peacekeeping Operations at the United Nations, but somebody who has worked on these issues for many years. And then to Sam Worthington, the President and CEO of Interaction, which has so ably I don't know quite what the word is, but so ably represented, let us say, the interests of major American NGOs and has become an important factor in the Washington scene and abroad on the issues that concern the NGOs in these types of operations. Providing the personnel, of course, is only the first step in meeting the challenges that we face. These guys in the field need to quickly understand their environment and begin operations in cooperation with other organizations. And it's with that in mind that Bob Perito, a number of years ago, undertook with a coordinating committee the redoing of a guide that had previously been published by USIP. And this new edition, which is just out, is the occasion for our meeting this morning, this new guide for participants in peace, stability, and relief operations. I want to mention just a couple of names of the steering committee that was involved in preparing this document. It's really quite an extraordinary steering committee. I don't think you'll find this group of organizations or people together anyplace else in the world. Colonel John Agolia, the director of the U.S. Army Peace and Stability Operations Institute, who's here, Chris Ho of the State Department, and Roy Williams, president of the Center for Humanitarian Cooperation, were all involved in this effort, as was Don Calabia of the UN Information Center and Karen Gutierrez of the Naval Postgraduate School, who couldn't be with us today. Bob Perito, at the end of our program, will do a bit of an introduction to the guide. I do want to mention two other USIP efforts. One is available to you. You don't even have to pay for it. It's the Guidelines for Relations Between U.S. Armed Forces and Non-Governmental Humanitarian Organizations in Hostile or Potentially Hostile Environments. This is a result of a two-year effort that USIP and State Department, SCRS, were involved in. And it involved an ample discussion between interaction on the one hand and the Defense Department on the other hand of the issues that arise in hostile environments between NGOs and military forces. And they've come out with a set of guidelines which are now being widely disseminated both in the NGO community and in the military community that we hope will help them avoid some of those problems in the future. And I recommend this document highly. I think it will be a continuing effort to avoid some of the problems we've had in the past, and I'm sure new problems will arise. The working group that did that will continue to meet and be concerned with implementation of the guidelines, revision of the guidelines. I do also want to mention that we have launched, in cooperation with the Peacekeeping and Stability Operations Institute under John Agolia, an effort to assist SCRS in drafting a document that will be doctrine for civilians in peace and stability operations. And that effort has just been launched and will take us at least the next year. With too many introductory remarks, I will then turn over to Ambassador John Herbst, then David Fastaben, David Harlan, and Sam Worthington. John?
And thank you, and it's a pleasure to be here. I'd like to thank Dan and Bob at USIP for the invitation and the opportunity to talk about my current favorite subject, and that is how the U.S. government tries to organize to deal with reconstruction and stabilization crises. SCRS is 3 years old, a little bit more than 3 years old, and we were created precisely because we recognized after Afghanistan and Iraq that our organization for dealing with such crises was inadequate. And we were given two tasks, simple to describe, not so simple to achieve. The first task is to make sure that when you have a stabilization crisis that engages U.S. national interest, that the entire U.S. government is organized to deal with that crisis, especially on the civilian side, but also to ensure that what the civilians do and what the military does is linked up. That's job one, or I should say task one. Task two, which is no less important, is to make sure that when we have such a crisis and we are going to engage, that we have the right group of civilians trained and equipped and ready to deploy quickly. These tasks are easier to state than to achieve because essentially they require a major change, you could even say a revolution, in the way the U.S. government organizes to deal with such crises. Some people have compared what we're trying to do to the efforts in the 80s to create a combined Joint Chiefs of Staff to ensure that the different branches of the military operated in coordination one with the other. And I think there's some validity to that analogy. So where are we on our two tasks? If I had spoken to you 8 months ago, I'd have a much gloomier assessment than I have today. Essentially, this is what we've got. We have an agreement interagency at high levels as to how the U.S. government should organize to deal with the stabilization crisis. It involves the use of three or four, depending upon how you count, models. The first model is the creation of something called a country reconstruction and stabilization group to manage such a crisis. This is essentially an assistant secretary level group, which in this administration is called a policy coordinating committee, devoted to stabilization reconstruction work. It's a group that would be chaired by a combination of the relevant regional assistant secretary of state, the relevant senior director at the NSC, as well as the coordinator for SCRS. Point of fact, having three people in the chair is not a recipe for order. It is a recipe for bureaucratic compromise. And that reflects part of the difficulties of our task. But my assumption is that when you have a real crisis, you'll have a decision from senior political levels as to who's in charge. My other assumption is that even if you have no such decision, SCRS is not in this in order to run things. SCRS is a process organization. We are here to make sure that when the policy is made, we have the wherewithal to carry it out, and that when policy is made, all parts of the U.S. government are moving in the right direction. So we make the trains run on time. So this is the first element of this interagency, what we call an interagency management system. A second element, and if you count it as two, then you get four models, is a secretariat for this country reconstruction and stabilization group. While the CRSG will be run by, as I said, this Hydra headed monster, the whole interagency participates, and the secretariat would be run by my office, SCRS. It would also be interagency. And in fact, SCRS is an office which sits in the State Department, but which is designed to be fully interagency, to have people coming in from other agencies to ensure that the entire interagency participates and shapes what we do. The secretariat makes sure that there is a single channel for providing information, for helping to formulate options, and for ensuring the implementation of policy decisions. The third organization in this interagency management system is something we call an integration planning cell. This is a group of people, interagency staffed, run by SCRS, that deploys to the military command if there's a military aspect to the stabilization operation. The point of this group is to ensure that civilian and military planning is completely in harmony, so that what the military does takes account of civilian needs and vice versa. The last model is the advanced civilian team, which deploys to the country in crisis. This advanced civilian team will, in most instances, be led by SCRS, interagency staffed. If there's an embassy, a U.S. embassy in the country in crisis, then this team will operate under the Chief of Missions Authority. If there's no embassy, this is the senior civilian USG presence in the country. And the point here is to make sure that all the activities of the U.S. government involving multiple agencies is coordinated, that we don't have two or more agencies performing the same function, or running operations which are serving at cross purposes one to the other. So that's the basic model. It has been approved at high levels in the U.S. government. It has been said that we should be using this model to manage the next stabilization crisis. I hope that's true, and I will certainly do my best to make sure it is true. Because right now it's just theory. We have to actually implement it in a crisis to make it the working arm of the U.S. government. Our second task concerns the creation of a civilian response capability that is prepared to go when we have a crisis. We have devised, and this has been approved interagency at senior levels, a three-tiered system to get civilians on the ground quickly in a stabilization crisis. The first tier, the inner core, is something we call the active response corps. These are people who have all the skills necessary for a country where a government does not function. We're talking about people who have and can help oversee engineering projects, the whole system of the rule of law. We're talking about policemen, corrections officials, judges, public administrators, health officials, economists, in some instances maybe port operators. Again, all the skills you might need in a government which is not functioning, or to buck up a government which is extremely weak. The plan is the following. Right now, my office, SCRS, has a tiny, tiny active response corps of 11 people. And since we're talking about State Department Foreign Service officers, we're really not talking about that broad breadth of skills that I've just described. We have a few of them. We have some police capability in SCRS, for example, as well as, obviously, economists and management skills. But this tiny group is a group which is able to go out to a crisis within 48 hours, and they've actually done that on very small scale. If the State Department's FY08 budget is approved, this number will triple to 33. More importantly, we have agreement at high levels in the U.S. government that we will create, using the FY09 budget, an active response corps of 250 people. And this is actually something quite substantial. And this active response corps will be spread throughout the interagency. While roughly 40% would be in the State Department, although, and of those, by the way, not most would be in my office. DS, INL, and other bureaus would get a large chunk of those positions. About 40% would be in USAID. And the other 20% would be in places like Justice and Treasury and USDA and Commerce and so on. And when we create this larger active response corps, we will be able to ensure we have all the skills that I've already described. These are the folks who will help man the interagency management system, the advanced civilian team, the integration planning cell. These are the folks who will be the first ones on the ground, and they literally will be trained and equipped to deploy within 48 hours of a decision to send them. The second pool of personnel that we will create to staff to run a stabilization effort are something we call the Standby Response Corps. These folks will sit also throughout the civilian interagency. In fact, the way we look at it, there should be approximately 8 standby corps members for every active response corps member. So that means we're talking about a standby corps of about 2,000. Now, the active response corps members, their full-time job is to be ready to deploy. So when they're not deploying, they are training. They may be doing some task which is related to stabilization in general from Washington, but when the call comes, they're on. They're gone. The standby corps are people who have full-time jobs in the various agencies, but they will train for 2 or 3 weeks a year. And our hope and expectation is that up to 25% of them could be deployed once a crisis hits. I think that 25% is actually a high figure. I am confident we could deploy 10%, but maybe up to 25%. These folks will be deployable within 6 to 8 weeks of a decision to send them. And so that's the second group. Oh, there's one other important point here. Because these folks are coming out of jobs which need to be done, we have to make provision to provide some fill-in behind them. And our budget request will reflect that. The third element of our civilian response capability is the one that's received the most attention. That's the Civilian Reserve Corps. The Civilian Reserve Corps, a decision was taken months ago that we should create as soon as possible a Civilian Reserve Corps of 500. That's a very modest number for a Civilian Reserve Corps, but still it's a real corps. If you can create that, you could begin to do some interesting things with it. We received in the Iraq-Afghan supplemental budget request that was passed in May up to $50 million to begin creating this. We hope to soon pass authorizing legislation which will enable us to actually use that money. If we get that authorizing legislation passed within the next month or two, I promise you that by the end of 2008, we will stand up this 500 person corps. It will be recruited, trained, and equipped. It's also been agreed that we should seek to build this corps from 500, once we establish the 500 person corps, to 2,000. And this too we're also looking to do as we put together our FY09 budget. The expectation is that we could put these folks in the field within 2 months of a decision to deploy. The Civilian Reserve Corps would be comprised of people who are, like in our military reserves, in private life, in state and local government. People would sign up for the Civilian Reserve Corps for a period of 4 years. During this 4-year period, they'd be training for 2 or 3 weeks every year, and they'd have an obligation to deploy, if they are called, for up to 1 year during this 4-year period. We figure we could deploy approximately 25% of this corps at any given time. So let's do a little bit of basic arithmetic. If we have a 250 person active response corps, a 2,000 standby response corps, and a 2,000 civilian reserve corps, and we're deploying 25% of both the standby and the civilian reserve corps, and 75% of the active response corps, then we're talking about being able to put in the field in a crisis close to 1,200 trained and skilled civilians. Had we been able to do that early on in Iraq or Afghanistan, I think we would have a smoother operation. That's the basic plan. We have still a ways to go to achieve this. I've laid out for you the vision. I can tell you that there's support for this at very senior levels in the administration. And I am confident that in the next 2 or 3 years we'll be able to put this thing together. It's not a certainty, but we're making good progress. Thank you.
Thank you, John. General Fasteman.
Well, I imagine it's indicative of how your life has been going lately. When you get an invitation to speak at something that has the word challenges in it, you immediately know, well, I've got a lot of material for that. And I do have a lot of material based on my recent experiences in Iraq. I went to Iraq in June of 06, just as the violence started to get dramatically out of hand, and came back in July of 07, just as it started to get better. So I don't know if you should take my comments with too much seriousness. I would like to talk a little bit about the context of the challenges we face and why they are indeed challenges. And the broadest possible context for what we're dealing with here, I think, is the fact that we are in an emerging strategic environment of persistent and irregular conflict. Now, much ink has been spilled about what irregular conflict is, and I'm not going to do anything more on that at this time, but I would just like to point out the most important thing about irregular conflict, however you define it, it's not regular. It's not regular. Iraq is not Afghanistan. Anbar province is not Diyala province. Muqtadiyya in Diyala province is not Bakuba. Bakuba in June of 06 is not Bakuba in July of 07. It's not regular. And this is a problem for us because we developed our society and our institutions in an industrial era where the basic premise is things have a pattern, and patterns are important to us. And now we're in a strategic environment where things do not have a pattern. And so we are living with institutions that are built on patterns, and we are in an environment where the patterns are very elusive. And this causes no end of problems, as you can imagine. Another significant impact of this strategic context of persistent irregular conflict is that there's an incredibly rapid evolution in what you're experiencing. I mean, because the conflict doesn't really exhibit patterns that you can easily recognize, what we know about the conflict evolves very rapidly. You have a mobile adversary who likes to go into complex spaces, complex terrain and complex population mixes and a complex information environment, and they immediately move to where you're not. I mean, it was always almost axiomatic in Iraq. Whenever we went somewhere where we had not been, you'd always hope, well, when we go there, hopefully it won't be so bad. It always was. Always was. Because they are very adaptive, very mobile, and they go to where you're not in order to avoid your capabilities. In short, things change very rapidly, and therefore there's a huge primacy on adaptation. Now, some of the implications of this type of context of irregularity, one of them is the challenge of categorization. I guess the mildest way I can put it is I've come to believe that categories suck. We started out in a major combat operation, then we were doing peacekeeping, then it was stability operations, then, oh no, it's a counterinsurgency, oh, actually it's a sectarian conflict, and maybe now it's going to evolve to be disarmament, reconciliation, and advisory operations, hopefully. The categories don't mean much on the ground at all. It used to be the way you solve problems is you decide what the category is, and then there's a solution stream that goes with those categories. And I will tell you, it does not work anymore. Absolutely doesn't. So all the energy we put into deciding whether it's an insurgency, a global insurgency, or a sectarian conflict, or clash of civilizations, is all useless for the most part, because there's not a solution strategy that goes with that category and helps you out. So categories are no longer nearly as useful as they used to be in helping us solve problems. Another problem is there's an immense collapse of boundaries. There's a collapse of boundaries, particularly between categories. I can't remember, because Iraq seems like one long day. I don't know if it was, frankly, I don't know if it was the fall or the spring, but we were running F-16s down Haifa Street, which is right outside the green zone. We had some seriously kick-ass peacekeeping going on doing F-16 strikes on Haifa Street. And the embassy gave me a call and said, hey, I hear we're bombing Haifa Street. I said, yes, we are temporarily. Things are a little sketchy there. So yeah, we're doing that. And said, okay, well, we got a sewer project going on Haifa Street. Can you be careful about the sewer project? I said, absolutely, we'll do everything we can. But the categories just don't do it for you anymore. There's a collapse between echelons. We had, at Multinational Forces of Iraq, the exact geographical footprint that Multinational Corps Iraq had. And anybody can imagine the immense potential for redundancy and complexities when you share a geographical footprint with your subordinate headquarters, and there was that, to be sure. But in this case, it was necessary because of the workload of integration and coordination that had to happen between Multinational Forces Iraq and the embassy and the ministries of Iraq on the one hand, and then the Corps that was trying to run this 160,000-man tactical organization. So the normal type of echelon and assignment of responsibilities you had was tremendously complicated. And the information flow was dramatically different from what you would normally expect in a military operation. Information flow from the bottom was generally of much more value than what was coming from the top, because it is a small bore, and it's the people at the bottom that have a much better understanding of what's going on. And again, everything is unique. Nothing is standard, so your normal processes were tough. Boundaries between institutions get very problematic. Usually to seriously solve problems, we had to break the boundaries between institutions, put together things that generally had the label fusion cell in them, and I know with interest, CSRS has an integration cell, exactly the kind of thing that's needed all the time. Energy fusion cell, reconciliation fusion cells, intelligence fusion cells, they happen all the time. And when you go to these fusion cells, you find representatives of the various communities, not just within the military, but across the interagency. And then, of course, there's some collapse of boundaries between platforms and functions, but that's military stuff, and I won't drill that hard right now. We found, because of this irregular, complex environment, that often bottom-up local solutions were much more viable than national comprehensive solutions. Planning is typically bottom-up. We grow up in the military expecting we're going to get a plan from higher headquarters. We do a mission analysis, and then we give our instructions to the lower headquarters. I did several mission analyses as multinational forces of Iraq. These were mission analyses of the subordinate plan, looking at the subordinate plan of MNCI to determine how could we bring in the non-kinetic pieces to reinforce that plan. What can the State Department do? What can the ministries of Iraq do in order to reinforce this plan? It's totally different from what we grow up with and what we teach in military planning. And as I mentioned before, always a huge premium on agility. And I think we're pretty good with agility in the operational sense in the military. But to be sure, we, like most institutions, have problems with institutional agility. Manning, resourcing, authorities, and organizing. These are all challenges we all face, and we certainly have those on the military side. I think all of these challenges point to one thing, and I like to describe it as kind of the longitude problem of our era. If you've ever read that remarkable book, Longitude, it talks about, you know, the challenge to determine longitude, and it fascinated Europe for several centuries, finally solved by John Harrison in the 18th century. I think the longitude problem of our day is integration. It's always been about integration. I mean, the history of our recent development has been integration. The United States emerged as a serious military contender because it was one of the first countries to solve the integration problem of combined arms warfare. How do you get the tools of the modern industrial era to work together on the battlefield, combined arms warfare? Then we ratcheted that up in the 70s and 80s and 90s and seriously advanced the art and science of joint warfare. How do you get the efforts of the services to be integrated together? Now, the next level of integration is how do we integrate military action with the other agencies of government and with the agencies of non-government? That's the longitude problem of our era. Everybody has a problem with integration. And I alerted immediately when I heard that you needed an integration cell, because, trust me, you're not alone. So, drilling down to the challenges of integration, what makes integration so hard? Some of the persistent issues we face on integration, of course, is authorities. And the military, we're all about authority, as you can imagine. And we have a well-developed type of authority. You know, we have command, we have operational command, we have operational control, we have tactical command, direct support, general support. I found in Iraq there was another type of command and control relationship. I called it NAGCON, because in many cases, all we could do would be to nag people to get certain things done. There are no authorities for some of the interagency situations you're in, but often it was just nag, 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 would you please, because you don't have the authority. And that's the nature of life. We kind of built a government along those lines so that no one entity has total authority, so we shouldn't be surprised that we're having challenges of solving this integration problem. Budget, of course, is an issue. I heard the budget word many times in the previous presentation. I'm not complaining about budget. And from the military viewpoint in particular, to put it in a perspective or an end perspective, if you will, when we were planning the surge, we realized we're going from 15 brigades to 20 brigades, brigade combat teams, and it dawned on us that, well, we're going to need another combat aviation brigade, so we have the appropriate amount of combat aviation brigade support. So we asked for a combat aviation brigade, and we got it. my British counterparts were just oohing and aahing at the capability of the United States to send what it needed. They asked the question, how much did that cost? I said, I'll find out. It was an $800 million decision to add the combat aviation brigade to the surge. So there is an imbalance in resources, to be sure. And I think, as an individual, I acknowledge that is the case, and that we have to have resources on all sides of this problem. One of the problems of integration is on the issue of just people and their cultural distinctions. This is not about talent, because there is extraordinary talent in the interagency community and the Department of State. And it's not about experience either, because the experiences they can bring to the problems you have in the field are unlike anything that we can muster within the military. But there are some cultural predispositions. I'll talk primarily about the State Department here, not about civilians in general, because I don't think you can say anything about civilians in general. But between us and the State Department, I would notice, to be sure, the military has a cultural disposition towards planning. We're all about planning. State Department guys, because of what they've done to date, it's mostly about reporting. I would love to take a State Department guy to a meeting, because they could write the best notes ever and make it even sound better than the conversation was. And our guys weren't so good at that. But when it came to planning, I'd take an Army guy, because planning is something they're not used to doing. I went through the book you're launching today. It's an excellent reference, by the way, and I was glancing through it, and I glommed in very hard on the description of military culture, because you always want to know, you know, how else can you learn about yourself? And it said we were about planning, precision, and predictability. And I accept the planning part in spades. Matter of fact, that's probably the most dominant thing you need to know about us, is that we're about planning when you're, with at least with respect to working together with us. Precision, yeah, probably not so much for Army people, because everything we do is pretty sloppy. But I do refute the notion that we're about predictability. Anybody that's confident in our business has no confidence in predictability, because we are in a business where not only are things hard and things are complex, but you're up against people whose purpose it is to surprise you. And you understand that predictability is something you're probably not going to get. I say that because there is an important distinction and a challenge we face between us when we think about security. Because civilians kind of think of security as a commodity, that they can buy enough of it or get enough of it or be assured that it'll happen. And a military person doesn't see it that way. We see protection as just one element of this seamless dynamic of what happens when you're going up against an adversary. So many conversations I would have with my good friends, and they were good friends on the State Department side in Baghdad, would start to drift into, can you assure me, can you promise me? And I would always cut them off, and I'd say, I'm not assuring anything when it comes to security. Absolutely can't. This is not to say that the people I was dealing with lacked courage. They had immense courage. It's not an issue of bravery. It's a culture and a disposition and a way you grow up where you think about accountability when bad things happen, particularly in a society governed by the rule of laws. Most of us grow up thinking if someone gets hurt, then someone did the wrong thing, and someone should be held accountable. And people who make decisions worry a lot about whether folks will get hurt. We do too, but our sense of accountability is different, because there is an expectation that we at times will have to make decisions where unfortunately people will be hurt. We're accountable for those decisions, but we're not blamed for them in the sense that because someone got hurt, something necessarily went wrong. It's just a different mindset. Neither one is necessarily definitively right. But I found it's an important thing to understand when you're dealing with your counterparts. They're not cowards. They're not overcautious. They have a different sense of accountability, and it's because of the groups they grew up with. There's some interesting things about tiering, you know, from from the Secretary of Defense down to the squad leader. I think there's 12 echelons of command and control, typically. But when my State Department guys were trying to deal with the NSC, they only had to go through one or two levels. So often they would be having conversations at the very senior levels that I would be filtered from significantly because I was going through CENTCOM, Joint Staff, OSD, and others. So trying to talk about some of the challenges of integration we face. There's different tiers you deal with. And enough about challenges. So what are we doing? We're doing quite a lot. There's a lot of changes going on. We're executing a lot of doctrinal changes, which I think you've heard about. I won't try to bore you with them, but we put a lot of focus on our doctrine. We put a lot of focus on our concept development. We're not as behind on doctrine as you might imagine to how to deal with a irregular environment, because for years we've been advancing the notion that the Army has to be prepared for full spectrum operations, which is basically a seamless dynamic between offense, defense, stability, and support operations. And this framework has been in place for years, actually, if not actually in our doctrine as of 2001, even for the decade before that, frequently discussed and I thought well understood. Right after we seized Baghdad and we began to realize that this war wasn't over, there was a lot of discussion in the media about the complexities that we were experiencing and how the military was just beginning to understand that it's not just attack or defend, that there's other things that are going on. And as a person that had spent some time in the doctrine development community in the U.S. Army, I was slightly offended, particularly when a senior general officer made the statement that, we had no idea that this was going to happen. I had a chance to have lunch with him when he came back, and I said, "Sir, I don't understand why you let yourself be quoted that you didn't think this was coming. I mean, we've been talking about offense, defense, stability, and support for years. It's in the doctrine. It's very clear." He said, "Yeah, I know. But I can remember it clearly. I was in Baghdad in late April, and I was leaning up against the lamppost, and I was smoking a cigar and watching some guys pull some furniture out of a government building. And it just never occurred to me that I was going to be the guy to have to go get that furniture back." My point is, it takes a while for doctrine to set in. It's not just doctrine, and the words are good, but it's the experience everybody gets. And it's the imprinting of doctrine through experience that ultimately changes an army. That imprinting has happened. I categorically refute those who say the Army doesn't get into that stability operations, the Army's done nothing, the Army wants to go back to the Cold War. Those words are not recognizable to anyone below the rank of lieutenant colonel who's done nothing for all practical purposes but stability operations since he's been in the Army. And these people know a lot about it. They understand it. We have this inverted pyramid where the experience level at our junior officer level is far greater than the ones of senior officers. And we're leveraging that and getting good use of it. We've significantly changed our organizations. Instead of thinking in terms of divisions, we think in terms of brigades. The more modular they are, the smaller your pieces, the easier it is to move them around and to adapt to situations. We have about 126,000 skill assignments in flux that we've changed within the Army. We're about halfway through getting people retrained into entirely different jobs. That's a significant shift for us. You would not... if you were previously in the Army or visited the Army any time before 9/11 and think you know all about the combat training centers, you've got to schedule yourself for another trip to Fort Irwin because you would not recognize the combat training centers now. We have literally hundreds of civilian actors on the battlefield helping prepare our folks who are going downrange. I'm pressing on my time limit, so I won't go much beyond that, except to say that I'm happy to be invited here and to see the effort, the energy, and the interest that is on this topic. It is a main avenue of approach for us, I believe, in the future in order to improve this absolutely vital capability. I have to apologize in advance. I have to go talk to some OSD folks at 11, so I'll be leaving earlier than I planned, but thank you again for this opportunity to join you.
Thank you, General. We'll, I think we'll all remember for some time some of what you said. Categories suck, for example, NAGCON. Irregular warfare is not regular. We're going to remember those things. David Harland is fresh from the experience of attempting to write some doctrine for the UN peacekeeping operations. He is now director of the Europe and Latin America Division for DPKL. David?
Great, thank you very much. And yes, categories suck very much. And the observation about the military being good at planning is also great, and the State Department perhaps being less. That is a continuum that continues to the United Nations, I should say. And in fact, it was planned that Jane Lute would be here. Then the Security Council said we should have a mission in Darfur, and Jane Lute is our peace czar. Her husband works here and is the war czar, apparently. But she's the peace czar. So she was sent off to Darfur to organize how our mission will work there. And she is trying to infuse some family type of planning into that. I have to say that what I have to say is probably not all that interesting to the world beyond First Avenue, in a way. I mean, except to say that listening to the first two speakers, I mean, clearly we are all somehow about trying to get to that effective, quick, integrated operations. And hearing Ambassador Hurst come at it from what we don't have but could potentially have on the civilian side, and then hearing the general talk about what is there on the military side but is not complete and needs to be morphed into something else, are in fact the alpha and the omega of the same problem we have on our very little parochial patch on the other side of First Avenue. So the challenges for us are roughly the same as the challenges for everybody else, doing the right thing and doing it right. And I'll speak first about doing things right. And I'll say that because actually doing the right thing is the bigger problem in the United Nations. I think the bigger challenge for the United Nations in terms of being an effective actor in the post-conflict environment is making sure we are going to the right places. We are a very specific tool, and I think a great tool for the particular set of jobs, but making sure that we are a hammer hitting nails is very tough in our context. So let me first talk a little bit, just for a few minutes, about the easy side, which is what we need to get right. Now, obviously, in the United Nations, for various reasons, we are not going to have the world's biggest or best armed forces immediately at our disposal for the operations that we launch. We're also not going to have the colossal resources on the civilian side. We're not going to have the huge development resources that the World Bank can bring. I think we are sort of industry leaders, if you can put it that way, in a few areas. I think elections, constitutions, humanitarian logistics. I mean, there are a few of the post-conflict niches in which we are industry leaders, but largely we are not. So you have to ask, what is it that we bring that others don't bring? And I think you can debate that. But at the moment, I think it's two things. Legitimacy, international legitimacy that comes with Security Council blessing. That can be incredibly useful, or at least flip the other way around, it can be incredibly painful not to have it if you're intervening somewhere and you need to assemble a nice big international coalition, or you need to persuade local political actors that that you are a genuinely disinterested party or whatever. And there are also contexts where it doesn't matter a dime. You can meet, you know, a young drug-crazed 12-year-old with an RPG in the jungle of Congo, and you can have all the legitimacy you want, and it doesn't matter. But irrespective of that, legitimacy is one of the distinguishing features, I think, of a UN deployed operation. The other distinguishing feature, which will not be a distinguishing feature if Ambassador Herbst has his way, is that for the moment, we are the closest thing the world has to a one-stop shop, that is to a single place, a single structure which can deliver humanitarian development, electoral, constitutional, military, police, judicial, human rights, transitional justice, all under the authority of a single SRSG. I see one of our former SRSGs, SRSG Liberia, Klein, here. So it is a happy but maddening task, probably, to be there. And it's always great when we get a chance to torment our former SRSGs. Now, so in a sense, a part of doing it right, an important part on the UN side, is making the most of that legitimacy that makes us distinct and making the most of that one-stop shop capability. Sustaining legitimacy requires a number of things which we're horrible at. And the first one on my list, General, you'll be happy to know, is planning. And it's not just Jane Lute's non-appearance at this conference, but actually a whole range of other things. I've only taken over the Europe and Latin America division of UN peacekeeping relatively recently. When I was going through the files, I asked to see the planning documents for our deployment in Kosovo, and they brought out the old timer, and the old timer said, "Ah, yes, yeah." Well, actually, there weren't any planning documents because the council announced on a Tuesday that the mission would start on a Friday, and so we just sort of sent stuff and saw who was available. So, planning is a major hole for us. Timely deployment, which seems to be a big part of Ambassador Herbst's bailiwick, you know, getting the right people there during the golden hour when, you know, the cement is still wet and you know you can shape things before the baddies rush into the vacuum and so on. That is something we're particularly bad. I was the last long operation I was deployed on was Timor. And is it Ambassador Klein or somebody else has this great story of saying, you know, that UN deployed operations are sort of like imagining D-Day, where the people turn up in these, you know, what they call beach landing crafts, and one guy says, you know, I'm an engineer, but I really want to be a political negotiator, and somebody at the front says, you know, I'm a judge, but I don't speak the local language, so can I be an intelligence officer? And all of that is negotiated on the beach landing craft as the German incoming fire is there. And more importantly, all the other beach landing craft are all, you know, miles from being deployed. Watch Darfur. There's a lot of ground to be made up there. Related to that is effective and time. I think we're relatively good at deploying political people who are trying to play with the wet cement very early. I think Ambassador Klein did a fabulous job in Liberia with that. Sergio tried in Iraq. You know, we're relatively good at that, but we're relatively bad at what I would call the effective and timely service delivery to a host population. And almost everywhere we go, there's this sort of moment when fighting seems to have ended, and, you know, in a particular case where we've arrived, and people are willing, maybe because they're just stunned, maybe because they've had a horrible past or something, they're willing to give you the benefit of the doubt briefly. And if you can make life better for them, if you can turn on their electricity or their water, or if you can make it safe for Granny to cross the street, or if you can get their kids into school, then many of your basic political problems, including the capacity of the bad guys to mobilize the weapons and the people to do you harm, go away. And I think we're relatively good on the political side of that, and we're incredibly bad on, you know, what you call the hard service delivery, actually producing the guy who can switch on the electricity. And so we're going to be a major client of Ambassador Herbst as soon as he's up and running. Another one where we have our ups and downs is clear communications to the host population. I mean, peace has its enemies. There's almost always a power vacuum. There's almost always baddies rushing to fill that vacuum. The enemies of peace have their voice, even if the voice is only the guns and the sort of topping of the people they don't like, and the use of intimidation. And unless you have a really effective voice, including people who understand the language and the culture and help to put across the messages that will make your militarily very unleveraged, very unhighly geared operations such as we deploy, then you're in big trouble. And finally, we find ourselves getting tugged in by the toenail and then finding ourselves up to our neck in the poo-poo for many, many years in these places. And a lot of that is set very early by not having exit strategies which are somewhere in that zone between not leaving the country in the lurch. I think the UN Security Council, I mean, bless it, of course, they're our masters, but they used to love saying, okay, you had a successful election, the mission's been a fabulous success, now leave. And we have this great list of countries, Haiti, Liberia, where we've gone in, stabilized the country, had an election, left, and then some horrible butcher has come over and, you know, taken over the country, and it's then eventually collapsed back into conflict. So having an exit strategy that we can sell to the Security Council that is more than just saying we're going to go in, saturate the place with troops, you know, paint some schools, have an election and leave, and yet doesn't involve, you know, a major open-ended infantilizing political engagement where you get this horrible dynamic that's very easy where to fall into, which where I think, frankly, we're probably in Kosovo and a couple of other places, where it's very easy for the hosts to take a lot of authority and to leave you with a lot of the responsibility. You become very easy to blame, and it becomes the very dysfunctional nature of that relationship doesn't help the country, it doesn't help you to get out, but it very much helps the particular political elite who have grown up in this infantilizing political arrangement. So a proper exit strategy that is conditioned on intelligent observation of what constitutes political stability is very important. In terms of the other thing which I mentioned we bring legitimacy, and these are all ways in which we can lose it. And I should say, I mean, if we had longer time, I would say that we are actually trying to address these, but I was told to talk about the challenges, and we don't really, we're not an organization that believes in solutions. that's a joke. Yeah. So the other strength that we were meant to bring was one-stop shopping. I mean, that where, you know, I heard our first two speakers, I mean, in a way they're yearning for integration. I mean, obviously they're vastly bigger and vastly more sophisticated and vastly better resource operators, but, you know, we have the same problems on a Lilliputian level, but we also have some advantages in our Lilliputian system. In theory, all of these people are under the SRSG, or more or less under the SRSG's chain of command. But getting it right does mean we have to do more work in having a clear priority setting machinery that allows us to sequence and weight our effort as necessary. The UN is the classic, everything is top priority, therefore nothing is priority. You know, Lakhdar Brahimi used to say, you know, he went to Afghanistan, and he said, one thing I want to do is get this lawyer Jirga to get the balance of power right between the major tribes to see if we can then try and get a state going. And he said he was under amazing effort. You know, the Office for the Protection of Children in Armed Conflict said, okay, you can have your lawyer jirga, but it has to have exactly equal weight with your reporting and your engagement on, you know, the rights of children in armed conflict. So we have a certain degree of command and control under an SRSG and huge delegated authority to him or her, though at the moment they're all, 20 of them are hymns. But it does need to be improved. Second, we need to clarify a chain of command within the UN system and build the non-command relationships that have to build unity of effort within the UN system. We have a relatively antagonistic relationship within the family that I think is largely exacerbated on the military side by civilian SRSGs not giving effects-based direction, but being inclined to meddle too deep in technical military matters that they really can majorly screw up. And I think there is an analogous problem on the humanitarian side where we have SRSG setting political priorities, but then going too far into the humanitarian world, into how that should happen and when it should happen. We also, therefore, need a proper doctrine and rules and practices that allow the SRSG to give that political direction without interference, clarifies the chain of command between police and military operations. I have this effect on the military always. wait till I get to the civilian. Yeah. And allows the necessary space for humanitarian action. So have we managed to do these things, the getting it right, the doing things right? Not entirely, but more yes than no, in my view, and largely led by a great set of SRSGs. And I hope if we have question and answer time, we might have our SRSGs say a few words about these problems and how they're being dealt with. I think they are roughly improving. Now, the bigger problem, I think, on the UN side is doing the right thing. Doing the right thing is a bigger problem for the UN than for some organizations, in my view. UN peace operations are mandated, deployed, and financed by countries that have an interest in those operations, obviously. The problem is they sometimes have an interest in those operations even when there is no particular internal logic for having those missions. And a part of this is the peculiar nature of the UN system. The countries which mandate peacekeeping missions, the Security Council, doesn't provide the troops. The countries which provide the troops don't make the decisions and in general don't provide the money. So the countries that are making the mandate decisions are driven by political imperatives such as, oh my God, I have to do something. I don't want to commit hundreds of thousands of my own troops or whatever. Take it to the UN Security Council. The financial contributors and the troop contributors have analogous sets of interests. And, I mean, I don't say this to be too worldly or cynical, everything. Obviously, every country, every organization has its own set of particular political constraints. But the political constraints that operate on the United Nations are massively that which inclines it to deploy to places where it has no business being, where there isn't a peace to keep, where you're not going to give it sufficient resources, but everybody on the council has an interest in this operation going ahead. Anyway, I could give a couple of good examples there, but I understand we're on the record. But Jane Loot is in one of them. partly as a result of this sort of, you know, promiscuity of the Security Council, the UN, despite the fact not being, you know, all that loved an organization by many of its principal members, has become the principal actor in the management of armed conflict in the world today. There are, depending on how you count them, between 28 and 30 major armed conflicts in the world. And the UN is a major player, or the major player, in managing over half of them, including in the biggest ones, Congo and Sudan and so on. And in terms of casualties, you know, if you measure in descending order the world's conflicts from seriousness to less serious by the number of people killed, the UN is managing all of the most serious conflicts in the world. And so, in my view, it's particularly important that people in my position should have a good set of arguments when the Council comes along and says, you know, now we're going to have a peacekeeping mission to deal with, you know, the German invasion of Russia or in 1941 or whatever. And I think, which would have, if we had been there, they would have done it, I promise you. They are roughly that we have to be very, very sophisticated and clear and, what was the word, NAGCOM, about four basic principles. First, a peace to keep. The peace doesn't have to be great, but you have to have a mechanism for effectively engaging the principal belligerents and getting them interested in a durable solution. If you don't have it, we shouldn't be there. Second is a positive engagement with the region. It's incredibly hard to make peace, particularly with the resources we bring, if you don't have the region on board. The region can be a pain in the butt, and we have SRSG, Jean Arnaud, Lakhdar Brahimi, who are fabulous at engaging regional neighbors. But if you don't have a strategy, you lose the peace. The third is the full support of the Security Council. Missions where the Council is divided almost always go incredibly badly. The UN was set up in 1945, very much designed as the winners of World War II. It's us against them. It has quite effective decision-making apparatuses for if everybody's united. It has no mechanisms at all for resolving internal disputes among the five permanent members of the Council. So the Bosnias during the war and the Kosovos now are conflicts incredibly unsuited to the United Nations, in my view. And then the fourth is obvious, is a matching of the mandate with the resources. I would say about three out of four mandates we get are either not clear or don't have anything like the reasonable resources to match. And when I say, you know, not clear, you know, a classic example is the Bosnian safe areas during the war in Bosnia-Herzegovina. Somebody said, you should deploy the UN to defend the safe areas. And then some countries who had to provide troops said, no, we don't want to defend the safe areas. That's a military concept too far. So somebody said, okay, as a concept, as a compromise in New York, let's say you'll deter attacks on them. And they said, no, because then you need even more forces to deter attacks. And then they said, okay, let's write into the resolution, we'll deter attacks just by your presence. So the great resolution, 836, has this complete military and political nonsense. So I will end there, and I probably babbled too long, and just say that I think that the UN is doing many of the things that Ambassador Herbst is doing. I mean, that we also now have on-call teams, we have 25 on the police and the justice side. And I must say, as I hear that process, I realize we should be working closer because we are, in fact, but it should be much closer because we are trying to cook in our little world many of the same things. But we don't have a magic bullet for making sure that we aren't used for completely the wrong conflicts. And it's the application of UN peacekeeping to the wrong conflicts that screws the UN, screws those countries, and ultimately undermines the international capacity for conflict management. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much, David. Can I ask Sam Worthington to take the floor? And then we'll hear in the end from Bob Perito.
Well, good morning. You've heard from the U.S. military, the UN, now it's civil society, and we do herd cats at Interaction. The NGOs, as you know, are a disparate group of organizations. They're all over the world. To give you a little sense of the Interaction community, there's about 250,000 staff of U.S. NGOs on the ground around the world as members of Interaction. If you look at Darfur, it's about 9,000 individuals caring for 2 million people on a daily basis operating in Darfur. We are the people who are on the ground operating bottom up, usually there oftentimes before the disaster has happened, during it, and then right after. And as this program stated, the demand for NGOs has in our world has never been greater. I don't know if it's greater now than when it was during the tsunami. The tsunami, to some extent, was a circus. Our community, through interaction, raised about $1.4 billion. But I think the circus came in that we were relating to thousands of civil society organizations without the skill set, without the ability to respond, and simply acting out of the goodness of their hearts rather than trained institutions with capacities to operate on the ground. This was also true if we look at Kosovo. There were a dozen or so well-functioning humanitarian NGOs. But when the Kosovars were expelled, we found that European NGOs were pouring in, as were American NGOs, some of them without the skills to function. And yet we also find disasters around the world where our community is slow in responding. Close to more than a year, the UN, and I would also say very much the NGO community, did not respond to our Darfur, and it took quite a bit of pressure to get them to engage. Basically at this time, the UN actually had about 300 peacekeepers in Amman, unable to do much after the bombing of the Canal Hotel, and the idea of redeploying them to Darfur was again a challenge. We, the NGO community, also at times find ourselves bogged down with various missions and don't then redeploy as much as we can. And oftentimes it really comes down to this bottom-up, the ability of one individual to make a difference. Someone from the UN, Tony Lanzar, was an extremely energetic humanitarian coordinator, oppressed the UN system, tried to operate through bureaucratic channels, but really just got on the phone calling NGOs to make us actively present in the central CAR, the presence of NGOs then tripled, and what could have been a much larger disaster was avoided by the energetic efforts of one individual tapping this community's ability to be on the ground rapidly. But sometimes demand never is met. When we look at the 4 million or so excess deaths in DRC, or the fact that OFTA, the U.S. government, was pushing to have resources available in Kivu after some tribal violence, and the inability of NGOs to respond to that. We have the same situation for many years ago in Uganda, where there were a lot of NGOs operating in the south doing development, and Jan Egeland at the time was pushing them to move up into the north, where there were 1.5 million IDPs. So our community, in many ways, does have difficulty responding, and there are also some very serious barriers to our ability to respond. Our inability to negotiate in any way with the Taliban, to function without having a staff killed or being held for ransom. Both in Afghanistan and Iraq, we've been operating to some extent via remote control, email, phones, and occasional nervous visits. We unfortunately, during our last annual meeting, had to mark the passing of some 52 humanitarian workers working for U.S. NGOs, and this deterrent effect, unfortunately, of security at times causes us not to be there. At times, we're not present because we're simply frustrated with the government, and this would be the sad history of North Korea, where we first engaged had quite a large humanitarian response distribution of food, and it became very clear that we were unable to track or be engaged directly at distribution points, and that the issue of diversions was clearly something on our mind. And there are other times when governments simply refuse our presence. This would be the case of the Ethiopian government right now. And this is the NGO community and the International Red Cross being unable to work in the Ogaden and Somali regions, which raises concerns on our part that of widespread human rights abuses going on. And you could also move to a whole state, like the state of Eritrea, deciding not to have NGOs present. The point of these examples is to show that the ability of our community to engage around the world is not simply an inadequate labor pool or the lack of comfort of practitioners willing to go to dangerous places, but a much more complex one. And Interaction is attempting to deal with this in a few ways. In the guide, I think it gives a good example of Interaction, of this body that's there that coordinates the NGOs, but by the way, they can't really coordinate and you have to go to each one individually. I think we're moving beyond that. I think our ability to coordinate our community in any disaster, the community is getting together immediately, sets up a coordinating mechanism to discuss who is where, when. Oftentimes, the reality is very much disasters happen on us because we are in every country in the world, often placed in the areas that are the poorest and most likely to face some form of crisis. We've developed some minimum operating standards for staff. This is both for the protection of staff by organizations, of what we expect of organizations to handle, to do with their staff, as well as the behavior of our staffs around the world. We have an agreement with the UN called Saving Lives Together that enables us to be part of this broader security services, and we've been blessed to work very closely with Dave Vanness, the Secretary General of Safety and Security, and to really help shift our community to have a broader understanding of community. For the first time, Interaction now has security staff. We deal with the coordination of security issues that we find when emails go out discussing security issues, as was the case for CARE in Darfur recently. You end up having your country director kicked out. So the use of the word security with NGOs is a difficult one oftentimes for governments to live with. The issue of psychological stress is a big one for us. This is the case for the staff that we have on the ground on a regular basis in Darfur and Eastern Chad, oftentimes very isolated roles, as especially the internationals who come in. We have, I guess our jargon now is what we're calling staff wellness services, but the whole issue of the psychosocial support to staff operating in these very trying areas. Given the panel and the makeup of the room, I would like to just focus a little bit on sort of our community's response to the U.S. military's further engagement into the humanitarian area. And this DoD directive 3000.05 and this desire to fill the gap that is not being filled by other parts of the U.S. government. And we would very much applaud the efforts that Ambassador John Herbst is doing for the State Department. And what we've called on instead is for the Congress and the State Department is to really strengthen the civilian components of our government to assume these responsibilities. It's very much our belief that we should build on our comparative advantages. Our comparative advantage is that we are on the ground oftentimes 20, 30 years in a country with locals who understand the culture, who operate in difficult environments, who are able to function and exist there because we have the trust of local populations. This is not always the case, but we largely exist because of the humanitarian space given to us, because of the trust of local population and local populations understanding that we're impartial actors. The military security, other than planning, large skill set other than planning is security and security training and not civil administration. And I think we need to draw these lines as much as we can as we engage in these areas. And our challenge as a community oftentimes, and this is where these guidelines that we're very grateful for the USIP to help us work with Department of Defense in establishing them, begin to establish what we would call a fence with our good neighbors sometimes have a fence, and the joy of a fence is you have to do a lot of talking over it and a lot of relating. The fences also establish guidelines of where to operate, where not to operate. And we find ourselves oftentimes in the same area, we need to establish some norms. And this will require, I believe, a greater degree of discipline by the U.S. NGO community, a greater focus on our ability to operate on the ground and a greater accountability, in essence, to the local populations that we try to serve. Our challenge in trying to get some type of scale response to these problems, some attempt to manage them through some of the structures that have been discussed this morning, hopefully will not lessen the space, or that space which we call the humanitarian space, for populations to work with civil society in addressing their problems in a way that is impartial and based on their own needs. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Sam. I'm going to ask Bob Perito to introduce the guide. I want to, in doing that, express my particular gratitude to Bob for having shepherded this effort through years of I won't say difficulty, but serious discussion and effort. It's my ambition that this guide should go with every military officer and every NGO leader into peace, stability, and relief operations. So let Bob take a few minutes to explain what's in there.
Okay, thank you very much, and thank you all for coming out this morning. This is just an amazing turnout. Those of us that have worked on the guide over the last couple of years believe that it's a publication that should go out with everyone, every civilian and military member who deploys to one of these operations. It should also be available to everyone that's involved in training and education for those people that are going out to the field, and it's also a very useful ready reference for the people at headquarters and for people that do libraries and education. The guide is basically the result of experiences which the United States and the international community has had since the year 2000, and it's based primarily on the experiences that we've had in Iraq, in Afghanistan, in dealing with the 2004 Asian tsunami. Now, the book was designed primarily for field personnel. As you can see, it's the size that fits into a backpack or into a uniform pocket. Our military colleagues told us don't make it shiny, so we have a matte finish. It has a durable cover. It's not meant to be read from start to finish. It's meant as a ready reference. It's meant to be the sort of thing you can pick up and look up something quickly. It's full of follow-on references, websites, and other sources of quick information. Now, the guide was developed, as you heard, by an amazing group of people who have a broad experience themselves in peace and stability and relief operations, but also representing agencies that have similar responses. And it was not only written by members of the steering committee, who you've already met, Colonel Agoglia, Chris Ho, Roy Williams, and others, but it was developed by members of their staffs. Mike Esper's here. There are many other people, some of them in this room today, who wrote the section that deals with police and peace operations, written by police officers in DPKO, and who sent it down to us. And so we tried to go to those people who had the most precise expertise and get them to provide us with very concise descriptions of what they do or the problems that they face. The guide begins with a document or a framework which has been developed by USIP to help people understand and to organize the complexities of peace and stability operations. And it is the pioneering work of experts in a broad range of fields, but primarily Dan Serwer and Trish Thompson, our executive vice president, and others here at USIP who have developed this. And it provides a useful introduction to how to understand and deal with peace and stability operations. The guide then moves on to a series of scenarios. There are three scenarios in the guide which describe sort of what we thought were typical operations. The first is a relief operation in a natural disaster. The second is a peacekeeping operation where the United Nations has the lead. And the third is a stability operation where a coalition led by the United States and NATO would be in charge. These scenarios are not exhaustive, as you might imagine, but they're designed to introduce people to a type of operation people that may not have been in those kinds of operations before. It's meant as a training aid to give people who are going out to the field a kind of quick introduction to what they might expect. Now, we've heard the United Nations has the greatest amount of experience and in organizing peace, stability, and relief operations. The guide provides a description of the United Nations, the General Assembly, the Security Council, the major bodies. It also describes the various UN parts of the UN system. It describes how UN agencies and operations are organized in the field. And it, I think, is very, will give the person who's never dealt with the UN a very quick introduction to what the UN is all about. And it deals, also describes UN culture, the backgrounds of UN personnel, and how the UN operates. The guide moves on to describe this rather complex and sometimes rather confusing world of non-governmental organizations. The guide deals with critical issues that involve civil-military relations. It goes into the concept of humanitarian space, the standards established by the Sphere Project, which under which most NGOs now operate. It introduces the civil-military guidelines that Dan talked about at the very beginning, which were developed by the U.S. military, NGOs, and with the help of USIP. The guide categories NGOs in what we feel is a very helpful way. It puts them into categories of those NGOs that deal with humanitarian assistance, with human rights, with democracy building, and with conflict resolution. The guide talks about the expanded role of U.S. government civilian agencies in peace, stability, and relief operations. And Ambassador Herbst has given us a good introduction to the plans for expanding that role. The guide was written primarily by members of the SCRS staff, and it describes those operations. It also gives a description about how embassies are organized and how the United States government on the civilian side is likely to operate in the field. And finally, the guide provides an introduction to the U.S. military. It will be helpful to U.S. military personnel who are seeking to implement DOD Directive 3000.05, but it will be particularly interesting and useful to NGOs, international organization representatives, and other civilians that have to work with the military. The guide describes military culture. It describes the military's approach to dealing with problems. It discusses how the U.S. military is organized. And then it goes on in a very useful way, I think. To describe rank structure, acronyms, and all those other things that people want to know about and have a tough time understanding. We'll hope to get this back. The guide, as you might have noticed, is on sale in the lobby. It's also available via Amazon.com and on the USIP website at the USIP virtual bookstore. As an author, it's always somewhat disturbing when you discover that the book has already been discounted. and I fully expect in a couple of days I'll go into Borders and it'll be there on the $2 table. But it is available, and I hope that that you might stop on the way out and pick up a copy. And thank you very much.
Thank you, Bob. I'm going to open the floor. We have a little bit of time for Rob. For some discussion, some questions, let me ask people who have questions to line up at the two microphones, and I think it only fitting that we should start with a question from General Klein.
First of all, my compliments on the project. I think it's a useful one, well worthwhile. But I think that we'll find that the scenario we will next face is the scenario that you haven't covered, so you can expect that. Also, I just want to compliment, since David Harlan is here. Many of you don't know that David was actually the author of the final report on Srebrenica. And in spite of enormous attempts to edit it, undermine it, and use every kind of subterfuge to make sure it never saw the light of day, it did see the light of day. And I think David's conclusion is the right one, and the Secretary General supported it, that we, the international community, horribly failed the people of Srebrenica. And those are the facts. The question really is on the private security sector, which really hasn't come up in discussion. Because there are now corporations and entities prepared to engage with ambulante, tanks, planes, personnel, everything needed to really deal with the crisis long before we can ever get our act together. That is not only on the, let's say, military side, but also on the civilian humanitarian side. How does one deal with that? Does one support it? Does one encourage it? And what are the pros and cons of this?
I think of turning to you first, John. Sure, you can take it from there, or whichever you prefer.
Does this work?
Yeah.
It really depends upon the conflict in question. If we're talking about a stabilization operation where the U.S. government's involved, I mean, clearly we have used private contractors to handle elements of security. And the system we're creating, I think, will probably make that a little bit less usual than it has been thus far. But I can tell you that we have been grappling with this issue, and there are a variety of possible outcomes. I realize that's a very abstract answer, but the point is that aside from troops, the only thing the U.S. government has to handle security is the Department of Security, the State Department, which is very small and has had to rely upon contractors. I think an equally interesting question pertains to a circumstance where you won't have a government going in and you have NGOs involved and what they might do in those circumstances.
Sam, that's a perfect pass over to you.
No, I think we actually just had an article on security and dealing with private security contractors and the different interpretations of security, because if you're looking at it from walking down the street, and it's one thing to have an NGO go by, it's another to have a armed vehicle go by pointing weapons at you. And so I think it really depends on the ability of that context of, are you destabilizing the ability of a community to reestablish itself because there is enough stability for non-governmental organizations to operate sort of below the radar screen with enough security to function? Or do you need some force in there? And our challenge as a community is that we really need to distance ourselves from that force, especially if they are out of uniform. The concern would be that there would be a misidentification between who is an NGO and, in essence, operating on the ground as a humanitarian worker, and who is there armed and providing security services. So the more there's a blurring between that line, the less there is an ability of the NGO community to function, and the higher the likelihood that we would pull out.
I might add, before I call on David, that certainly there are a number of NGOs who find it absolutely critical to have security services provided privately, including USIP, at least in Iraq. David?
I have a private view. I don't know whether it's the UN view. And that is, first of all, clearly the private military actors, who are the problematic ones, are coming. And in a way, it's a reversion to normality. I mean, for most of the history of armed conflict, the state has not had a complete monopoly. I mean, my childhood was spent playing with pirate ships, toy pirate ships of, you know, licensed British privateers who were the British government's, but they were officially licensed pirates by the British government as a mechanism for dominating the Caribbean. And
we remember those.
Yeah, you remember them. And, you know, I think as late as the 19th century, the arsenal, I mean, captains of ships had to buy their own cannonballs and gunpowder from privately owned arsenals and so on. And the state monopoly is largely a function of this hyper-industrialization of warfare of World War I, right? And clearly we're reverting to a more normal state of affairs. I don't doubt their capability, and I don't think they're entirely malevolent. I mean, Ambassador Klein himself might have a view on Sierra Leone and Leonardo DiCaprio, no. And where I think the private military companies that were engaged by the government, A, to defend them, and B, to defend the revenues from the diamond fields, A, did a good job, B, were cost-effective, and C, were missed by the local population when they left. And so I don't deny their capability. And in fact, I personally had a call from a private military company guy who says, you know, you've got problems of whether or not these would be wild geese types. It's not true. I'll get you two regiments of Gurkhas. We'll clean out the Kivus. Believe it, you want human rights standards? Fine, just tell me what they are. If you want everybody sliced up into fricassee, just tell me. They'll do that too. And I actually don't deny that they have the capability to deliver. Where I think I have a problem is the Pandora's box issue. You know, the government could pay them because they could get the guys to control the diamond fields. Well, what happens if Uber baddie, you know, some Batman, like, you know, or the Joker comes and says, okay, I'll pay you twice that to control the diamond fields. So I don't doubt it's coming. I don't doubt they have the capability. But I think that before there's any sort of endorsement or support or use by people like us, the regulatory framework should get a lot better. They already have. I mean, frankly, as you know very well from having to deal with some of your more out-of-control troops, the UN's actual capacity to control on disciplinary grounds its own troops is already pretty lame. So the standards of accountability, I mean, I shouldn't, that's off. Or needs improvement. But the standards of the private military companies don't have to be raised sky high, but they do have to exist. And now, frankly, they don't exist enough. So I think they're coming, but not yet.
Please.
I am Bob Pearson. I am a retired Foreign Service officer, and I was the Director General of the Foreign Service before I retired in 2006, and I had the pleasure of writing the paper that set up the SCRS office. And I will say to John Herbst that I am delighted to hear all of the things underway, because they do fulfill many of the original missions of the paper, and I had just written an article on the origins of the office, which I sent to John. I would have asked Jock Klein's question, because I think the private security element now is a fact in what we will be doing. But let me ask a slightly different question then. If I heard it correctly, and let's just assume, and it'll be my bias, that UN operations in general are not focused on military solutions while the civilian and political solution is being created. Whereas there is a kind of sense I've heard on the U.S. side that somehow the military side of it has to have a greater proportionate weight. And I'd like to hear some discussion about whether this is simply a reaction to different kinds of security challenges, and therefore an example of the kind of flexible solutions that have to be created, or is this partly a product of the American way of thinking about security, and that we are looking at different kinds of operations where we will be more muscular in our military component in arriving at these kinds of solutions?
Thank you for that question. I'm sorry the general isn't here, but we have a number of uniforms in the room, and if anybody wants to step in on this from the military side, please do. John, you want to try that?
There are two separate issues here, as I see it. On the one hand, on the specific question of providing security in an insecure environment, a non-secure environment. I'm in charge of an effort to create a substantial civilian capability in countries which are not stable. Part of my job is to make sure I can present a proposal which will be acceptable not just to senior members of the administration, but also to the Congress. Part of that is keeping costs down. to provide adequate security while keeping costs down, you need to use the military as opposed to private contractors who cost several hundred thousand dollars a year per person. It's really that simple. Having said that, there are circumstances where you will put in trained civilians where people are shooting. And so in that case, we'd be looking more towards the military to provide security in most, but not necessarily all instances, for the reasons I've already given. But there are also circumstances where the environment is permissive. In that case, you may still need security, but the security will not be military, because you're not going to introduce military merely to provide security for civilians on the ground. Our planning is for all types of stabilization operations, where the military is engaged and where it's not. And where it's not, we will be relying upon civilian contractors. But where it's not as well, we would expect the environment will be a lot less dangerous.
David, did you want to address this question of the difference between American and UN approaches?
First of all, I mean, it's a fabulous idea. So if it was your idea in its germ, then that's an amazingly good thing, and we're very happy. I think there is a difference in American approach from the UN approach, and I think the UN approach is born of necessity, but obviously we don't have the capability to shock and awe on an industrial scale. we don't have, you know, the command control arrangements, the intelligence arrangements, the logistics, the resources to sustain the battle rhythm or the tempo or to escalate. Whenever I see Jacques Klein, I always remember zillions of funny stories, but he has one about some battle with the budget committee, and he said, you know, you go there and you say you need 5 fire engines, and they say, okay, you can have 2 fire engines, no water. and, you know, imagine if you're the fire brigade, you can't operate that way. I mean, but it is the way we operate. And so I think by necessity, we have use the military in a relatively limited role as a part of a much wider palette of colors with which we, you know, paint the picture of peace. And politics is first, hearts and minds is second, support to civil administration. And if there's a need for a military, either provide general security, then we can usually do that. Where there's a need for precise operations, in Haiti, we've had some really interesting special forces driven operations in the last year, and Congo, Eastern Congo, we have had a sustained military operation now for about 2 years. So I think in general, by necessity, the UN has underemphasized the military as a part of its overall response to conflict management. Having been so sort of auto-disparaging, I would say it is, frankly, I've come to believe it's a strength. I mean, the problem with the hyper-kinetic sort of American military instinctive response is it solves a lot of problems, and it can create a lot of problems. It can create a lot of problems in the hearts and minds department. And, you know, frankly, a lot of these problems are, you know, no political solution, then it doesn't matter how much shock and awe you've got. I mean, if you haven't got a winning coalition, then you could have 10 times what the UN has, maybe even twice what the US has, but it ain't going to happen. And that was why I've been a skeptic on Darfur, because I think that the strength of the UN is that by our lacks, we've had to force ourselves to understand what is a minimum political operating environment to generate the political process that will lead to a stable outcome. And we've got moderately good at that. So yes, we are different. It's only come of necessity, but I think it has certain strengths, at least in some of the environments we operate in. Thank you.
I might comment just briefly that I think it's also necessity on the American side, the civilian effort having been handicapped in many respects relative to the military effort. And I think as John builds up civilian capabilities, I think you may see some changes in American approaches. Please.
Hi, my name is Monty Jewell. I work at the Lewis Berger Group, which is a private sector consulting firm involved in a lot of reconstruction efforts in Iraq, Sudan, and Afghanistan. And my question is, what do you see as the role of private sector for-profit firms that are increasingly increasingly becoming involved in these reconstruction efforts, and how do you see them fitting into the military UN NGO framework that you've described today?
If everything I've described becomes a reality, there will still be a substantial need for contractors. We've developed good relations with the NGO community, and of course they are the first place you look. I imagine if you're talking about an operation of a sufficiently large scale, there'll also be a role for the non-NGO private community. The system I described is essentially the interagency management system, and the civilian response which would fill it is essentially a command and control structure on the civilian side. And then you would have others who would need to fulfill the discrete tasks that have been assigned by that command and control structure.
I think just one of the values added by private contractors is you are delivering on a contract for the U.S. government a service, and do so very rapidly. I think where the NGOs start to draw a line is if that service, let's say the service is building local civil society, well, why not have civil society build civil society than a contractor? So it comes down to really what is the service you're asking? And if the service is aimed at engaging local populations to shape their civil society, schools, institutions, and so forth, it's usually better to use NGOs in that. If it is delivering of a service to establish rapidly something that is needed, a road or whatever, then I would go with the private contractor. So I think they're complementary services that have different functions, and there has been less attention than needed paid to the distinction between the types of services.
Can I be devil's advocate on that?
Please.
Just because we're sitting next to each other and he can hit me. But I would, you can ask that question the other way around, though. You can say, you know, I go to a lot of post-conflict countries and, you know, organization X, I mean, say it's a UN one, I mean, a UNICEF, says, okay, we do a needs assessment. But actually the needs assessment is really driven by how much money they think they can raise and how many people they've got. And they say, okay, well, X many children need vaccination. I shouldn't choose UNICEF because it's a great one, but any humanitarian organization, there is a very morbid relationship between those who do the needs assessment and those who then respond to it. The advantage of a private contractor system is that somebody else has identified the need. You said, okay, the priority in this country is kids need vaccination. And then I must say, having formerly worked for UNICEF, I mean, I don't care who then wins the contract, whether it's UNICEF does it paid civil servants, whether it's an NGO do it for principally good of the world motivation, or a hideous monster capitalist country does it. What I'm interested in is which will get the kids vaccinated and which will meet the real priority. And I think that, frankly, the NGOs would usually win, and that's great because they have cost advantages and they have other advantages. But I think that it should definitely be a more open marketplace, and we should try and cut the morbid link between those who define the need and those who raise the money to respond to it. I just don't apply it to ourselves.
Please.
Thanks. My name is Michael Wytrowski. Here as a private citizen, retired Army officer, served in Vietnam, Haiti, and Bosnia. I was also a college professor for 20 years where I taught criminal justice, and two of the areas that I was very interested in was community policing and community development. Out of my experience in Bosnia, I recently co-authored a book on democratic policing in developing and emerging countries. And one of the things that I find here is that it's kind of tough to look at you and look through reading glasses at the same time, but I think you have an underdeveloped idea of what security is. And you're speaking about it specifically in terms of people running around with guns, whether it's military security forces and so forth. But fundamentally, I think we need to look at security as something that's sociological, psychological, and social psychological. that it's the development of people and their ability to cooperate with one another to form social networks and to meet collective needs. One of the things that happens with conflict is the fundamental ties of society are shattered by people with guns and the ability to be coercive. Correspondingly, in post-conflict, post-communist societies, I've looked at this quite a bit, the entire concept of trust in those societies is undermined by intelligence, military, and the police. I'm going to cut this down to about 2 minutes. I'm just trying to get you to understand that you may want to rethink how you're thinking about security in the end state that you're trying to have occur. One of the things that we did, or I did in the United States 10 years ago, is I worked with community policing. And it was really interesting that these were not guys running around with guns, teaching people how to shoot, how to arrest, how to throw people to the ground and handcuff them. These were police officers that were committed to the concept, who went into dangerous neighborhoods where the fear of crime, maybe not as much as we have in Iraq right now, but civil society, social networks were shattered for a variety of reasons. And some of these people, men and women, got pretty good with working with communities and basically creating, helping to recreate what Rachel Neal has called citizen security, which is the idea of societies becoming functioning networks of people who can address what their priorities and needs and so forth are. What I'm suggesting now, and this was the outcome of the book, was that we need to go to the next level, and which is to engage the police in go from community policing to democratic development, to get them to understand that policing and security can both be massively coercive and corrosive of civil liberties, human rights, and destructive of civil society, or it can become something that can help to construct these things, but only if the people who are doing this understand what they're doing. Our experience, I think, and this is as a retired military officer in Iraq and Afghanistan, is that we may have tried to train police forces, but what I've seen from the reports that have come out would indicate that we haven't done a very good job of creating policing, down to the last 30 seconds, because policing is not about carrying guns and being coercive and arresting people. It's about people, as Sir Robert Peel said 175 years ago, to help communities, to help societies become self-regulating, self-governing, to implement social control so that the people do on a full-time basis what's the police do on a full-time basis, which is that which is incumbent upon the citizens to do. So, long story short, I'm asking you to think about, when you're talking about security, broaden it. Thank you.
Bob, I turn to you. A comment on this? Bob Pareto has made a specialty of the question of what security really means in these situations and community policing.
Yeah, one of the... That was a very, very long statement. One of the things that's happened that's been unique in Afghanistan and Iraq that didn't happen in the prior peace operations which we had engaged was that the United States military has actually been put in charge of police training. And this has had some somewhat unfortunate consequences in that we've tended to develop sort of militarized police forces. I'm very encouraged by what Ambassador Herb said this morning, that we are going to be, the State Department is going to be recruiting civilian police officers, and that these civilian police officers will be in a position to deploy early, that they will be in place, and hopefully they will have a role in the planning and the operation of future enterprises. One of our problems in both Afghanistan and Iraq is there were no civilian police missions attached to those operations. We didn't have in the very beginning the kind of UN police force, say, that we had in Kosovo and Bosnia. And the result of that was that the police planning and implementation lagged. And so I'm a great fan of what Ambassador Herbst is doing. I think this is going to give us a capability which we really need
not only in police but in the related areas of courts and prisons, the entire rule of law complex.
One last question.
Good morning.
It's on.
It's on.
Just speak into it.
Okay. Good morning. My name is Noriko Oes, working for Stimson Center as an intern, and then Georgetown University master's student at the same time. I have two questions. First question is to Mr. Herbert, just to clarify about the civilian reserve corps you talk about. Like, let's say if I were a person, American citizen, working for the Chevy Chase Bank, usually as full-time, can I register myself for to that civilian reserve corps and then being trained, and then can I be one of 500 people, just to clarify?
In theory, yes. Be welcome to
if you need the skill sets.
The answer is yes. When we talk about the first 500, which we're trying to create now, once we get authorizing legislation, mm-hmm. there'll be a heavy emphasis on policing and security, about 350 of the 500. Mm-hmm. But as we develop the larger core, there'll certainly be a need for economists and bankers. So if this is your background, pay attention to our website.
Your second question?
Yes, my second question is actually that I just got back from Darfur. In the first year, I worked there for humanitarian agency. So my question is that, like, there, my observation was that pretty much the African mission incident, AMIS force, their mandate, I believe, was that protecting civilians and the humanitarians as well. However, by now, they pretty much regarded as siding at very unpopular the whole peace agreement amongst IDPs, internally displaced people. So humanitarian colleagues of mine were discussed, were saying that Noriko, don't approach Amy. It really hurt. It will damage our impartiality. It will make our operation difficult. Don't approach Amy. So based on that brief experience, I want to ask that, is there any like mechanism like under development or already developed in the UN DPKO that try to like protect civilians but at the same time try not to hurt their impartiality? Is there any tangible mechanism being considered in your department?
David, you get the tough one.
Yes. there are actually several problems. I mean, one is this: Amos has a crisis of legitimacy, and that legitimacy is from non-delivery. So, and you see, that is the type of exact crisis of legitimacy we could very easily have. There, it doesn't matter who mandates you, and they can't deliver because there isn't a very good concept of military operations, at least when you're only 6,000 people in a place bigger than France. With that level of military capability, they can deal with that. That is a conflict that essentially has a political solution in which the provision of security and the protection of civilians may usefully push that political solution to sustainable peace. But the military, I don't think, can be a substitute for that political one. And the Darfur Peace Agreement, if one is allowed to say it, you know, frankly, isn't a great foundation on which to build the big edifice of enduring peace in Darfur. And I think that is a problem that is going to come back to haunt us. We've now put together this council of elders that is sort of like some Hollywood thing. Kofi Annan, Bill Clinton, Nelson Mandela, I mean, it's absolutely everybody, I think, is who you ever heard about is on it. Is that enough when dealing with the very hard men of Darfur and Khartoum? I don't know. And the second part of your question, the surface level of your question, is there a sort of an immediate doctrine for protection of civilians? I mean, yes, there is a tactical doctrine increasingly elaborated and shared with countries. But my sense is that far too often people say, well, we don't really have a political strategy, we don't really have a mandate, so we're going to ask you to protect civilians. And the military hates that too, because it's heavily resource intensive. You have people in all these camps or providing area security, and then one lot of baddies can do a hell of a lot of damage and set the whole thing back politically, and you then become a major political state scapegoat. So yes, there is a tactical doctrine in development, but I don't think that tactical doctrine is the answer to Darfur's questions, or in fact to most situations in which civilians are very vulnerable.
Sam, did you want to comment on this?
Well, we certainly welcome the shift and new troops coming in. Again, it really comes down to the nature of the mandate, because it could make things worse rather than better. And the distinction between in the mandate being one very much of security and solely security, and not security and humanitarian action. And the ultimate point that I think Dave is making is that this is a political solution, is the only solution that will result in some form of peace, and that means negotiating with very bad people.
I'd like to, at the end, give everybody on the panel an opportunity to say anything that they skipped or to sum up in any way. Bob? Sam? David? Well, we've had a very intensive couple of hours, and I want to ask you all to join me in thanking this magnificent panel.
Thank you very much for coming in. I will be getting together with Linda Petit next week, and we'll start to do that.
I'm trying to think of
Well, because I'm not very